Okay, why don't you try calling in again, okay? Bye-bye.
Well, hello, everybody.
This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where we talk about writing and life. We've been having a few technical difficulties. I hope they work out. Our guest today is Mr. Joseph Emmett, and he had been trouble getting on. Hopefully he does get on, and hopefully we can do our show. As always, you know, Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across those genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1995. Let's see. Joseph is here. Let's see if he can hear us. Joseph, can you hear
me?
Oh,
yeah, everything
wonderful.
Is cool.
Wonderful. Well, everybody, today I have with me, I'm just going to introduce him while he lingers on the phone. Today I have with me, and Joseph, I didn't have a chance to ask you, your last name is pronounced Emmett or Emmett?
Emmett.
Emmett. Well, ladies and gentlemen,
yeah.
Before I get to talking to him, let me introduce to you Mr. Joseph Emmett. He is, he's many things. He is a trained Zen master. He has a doctorate in music from Boston University and is the author of, among other things, among many books, Buddha's Book of Sleep, Buddha's Book of Stress Reduction, and Buddha's Book of Meditation. He's also the founder of the Mindfulness Meditation Center in Montreal and, most recently, the author of Finding the Blue Sky, A Mindfulness Approach to Choosing Happiness, Here and Now, out from Tarcher Penguin. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Hello. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. I'm glad we averted our technological disaster and we're able to chat with each other. Well, there's so much to talk to you about, but you know where I'd like to start for some of our listeners? Now, in truth, regular listeners to the show have heard me talk a fair amount about mindfulness in one form or another. But if someone came up to you and said, what do you do? And you say, well, I teach and practice mindfulness. And they said, what is that? How would you explain mindfulness to the uninitiated?
Well, it usually depends on the context. But in general, it has been defined as paying attention intentionally. and because there's all kinds of things attracting our attention, the media, the ads, the political stuff, your children, the traffic, problems at work. But pay attention intentionally. And in this context, it means learn to pay attention to what is working in your life instead of what is not working, what is going right for you. A wonderful way to direct your attention in a positive way instead of whatever is clamoring for it.
Mm-hmm. So be conscious and deliberate to what you pay attention to. Don't let it be sort of, you know, there was a movie called Up, and in it, it was an animated film by Pixar, and there was a very funny aspect to it. They had this dog that could talk, and the dog would be going along and having a conversation with whoever was the person that was looking after them, but then all of a sudden, it would stop mid-sentence, and it would see a squirrel, and so it would stop mid-sentence and go, squirrel! And so if it saw a squirrel, it had to stop what it was doing and look at the squirrel. And I always, when I think of mindfulness, I sometimes think of that dog and how I don't want to be that dog. I want to be able to keep my attention where I want it. Does that make sense?
Very much so.
As opposed to leaping.
The dog did not have much Buddhist wisdom, I guess.
That's right. And now... I've had a chance to talk to a lot of spiritual writers and teachers, and not all of them, but I would say very, very common story is that they came to their teaching usually out of a kind of necessity. In other words, this book is about choosing happiness, but once upon a time, it sounds like you didn't really know how to do that, that you couldn't, that happiness, you sort of waited to assemble itself for you. Is that accurate?
Very true, very true. And that is part of the theme of the book. It's sort of like there's some autobiographical material in it, in the sense that I wasn't born into a happy family. My parents were not happy people. So I had to find my way to happiness. And my apprenticeship with Thich Nhat Hanh, my Buddhist teacher, had a lot to do with it. At the very beginning, I talked about mindfulness for you and paying attention intentionally to what is good, what is working in your way, in your life, and that is a pretty good path toward happiness, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to me that the operative word in your title is actually in the subtitle, which is choosing, and I think for a lot of people, I think that the biggest shift most people have to make is the understanding that what we call happiness or well-being or peace or contentment or joy, love, you know, take your pick, that it's something that can be chosen as opposed to something that, like a bird, lands in your window or doesn't. That seems like always the first big perceptual shift that has to occur.
Mm-hmm. And originally, the subtitle was A Mindful Approach to Choosing Happiness, period.
Period.
And then it occurred to me, choosing happiness is not like choosing to buy this car rather than another one. It's a series of choices, like it's a choice you make over and over again at each moment, because that choice presents itself to you over and over again. You know,
the choice to, so in other words, the option to choose happiness is, it comes to you in every moment. You always have that choice again and again and again and again. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, it's not something you choose once and for all.
Yes,
unless if you want to like say it in a general way, like this is my life's purpose. I want to be happy. That's a choice. Like, you know, I want to buy this car. But then there is the moment-to-moment choice, because you're faced with different situations, and then to choose the positive path, the path that brings happiness in every situation, is what the subtitle now reflects: choosing happiness here and now.
Yeah,
over and over
but
again.
It's really an unconditional happiness. Meaning, you have to make the decision that your happiness, your well-being, your contentment is not conditional. Meaning, it is not dependent, maybe influenced by, but not dependent on the conditions. So, who's around you and what they're saying, and whether you've gotten a rejection letter or an acceptance letter, or whoever's president, for instance. All these things people might feel are no, they cause me or make me feel one way or another. And you say, no, it's actually your thinking ultimately that causes you to feel one way or the other.
In general, I think I would go along with that. Yeah. You know, the situations in the world, in your health, job, your relationship might trigger some anxiety that you already have. They're not causes, they're more or less triggers. But
right.
If you have a happy disposition, you might be triggered, but you don't drown in it. You notice a bit of anxiety coming on, but you don't wallow in it. So that's a disposition that you have created with practice. It's sort of like a trait. That you can depend on, that has become your default way of being, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I love that you use the word practice. The first time I heard Eckhart Tolle he described a walk in the woods as a good spiritual practice, and I lit on that word, practice, and I thought, yes, that's just it. You've got to look upon it as a practice, not something, not a point on the grid, but more akin to finding your balance, something you find sort of with every thought and with every step. It's you come back to it, you learn it and learn it and learn it really every day. I assume you're still learning it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And talking about practice, maybe I could talk about practice songs for a
yes.
minute now.
Well, yes, please.
I recommend to people who study with me to take a meditation break during the day, just like they take a coffee break.
And yeah.
Preferably two of them. And one way to do that is to go to my website, mindfulnessmeditationcenter.org. Center is spelled the Canadian way, with T-R-E at the end.
Right. Yep.
And Google and hit on the books tab. And the first two books contain about a dozen practice songs each. They're click and play or free download to your portable device. And you can listen to a song in the bus, in the train, at the coffee shop, taking a walk. It takes 3 minutes, but during those 3 minutes, it'll change your state of mind completely. The idea is that a song addresses both sides of your brain, the verbal and the nonverbal. And it also becomes an earworm. So it's 3 minutes, but then it takes over your mind for a longer period than that. And it prevents like stress from building up during the day. It sort of helps you keep your cool, so to speak, your perspective, and reminds you that this is what you want to do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, let me ask you, do you remember when you began this practice? It was a long time ago, I assume, at this point. Maybe not. It seems like when you went to Paris, you studied in Paris, was it, in, or France? Where did you study?
Well, you know, I've been dabbling
teacher?
In meditation most of my life since I was yoga meditation with Swami Vishnu Devananda, who had a big center here in Montreal, and then Zen meditation. But it really got into high gear when I met Thich Nhat Hanh, connected with him. His number of centers around the world, but the primary one is the oldest one, I guess, is Plum Village in southern France near Bordeaux. It's a beautiful, beautiful place surrounded by farmlands, vineyards, old churches. One church I visited was built in the 12th century. It's a gorgeous area of France, and that's where I really made headway in my mindfulness practice.
And when you say made headway, can you think of a time where you understood something significant that you hadn't? You understood something significant experientially, I should specify, that you hadn't before, where you began to really understand what it meant to choose your frame of mind, as opposed to just waiting for one to shift on its own. Can you remember an example of where that really happened for you?
Well, you know, this is not an instant thing, although sometimes in Zen circles you have an instant enlightenment, instant awakening, and Buddha's awakening is sometimes referred to as an instant occurrence. But don't forget that Buddha spent 6 years in the wilderness, 6 years as a wandering mendicant, meditating and practicing before he had that moment.
Me
too. I had many small awakenings. Many small during that time, and I think that was about 20 years ago, actually, my first trip to, and I spent a whole year there, you know, over several month-long trips, retreats, and so on. So it is a gradual path, and this is important to emphasize because sometimes people expect miracles from mindfulness or meditation.
Right.
Maybe they've been on psychotropic medications for 10 years,
right.
or they've been psychoanalyzed for 5 years, and they come to a meditation session and they want instant results. Well, I'm afraid it's more like, you know, learning to play the guitar or learning Spanish or whatever. It takes a bit of time. It, you know, because you're learning to reprogram your unconscious mind, and you hit on the word practice, and this is very true. There's practice there.
So I mentioned that you're the author of many books, and you also founded, and I assume continue to teach at, the Mindfulness Meditation Center in Montreal. So both in the writing and in your physical teaching, you've taken this practice and now brought it to a teaching level in your writing and also just your day-to-day life. Why teach? I mean, obviously the practice is a reward in and of itself. What for you is the reward in teaching, both whether writing or in person?
Well, two things. One is the knowledge that it's being a benefit to somebody and it's helping somebody. And, you know, one of the places I teach is a big hospital here in Montreal called the Jewish General Hospital, where I have sessions for cancer patients, and they know why they're there and the discomfort of the diagnosis and the treatment and so on. So one of the big incentives is to know that you're being of help to somebody somehow. The other big incentive for me is a learning experience. I continue to learn. There's this wonderful French author, André Gide, who said that the sage is the person who looks at everything with wonder. And the stories I get from people, both individually and in groups, they're always, always amazing, unique, and there's a learning somewhere there. You sort of say, yes, and this is also true. This is how we are. This is how we are, and we have these experiences, yes. So my books are motivated and full of stories of people that I encountered this way. And, they're a wonderful incentive. I never get tired of this, actually.
But that's important, though, because and every teacher I know, whether they teach mindfulness or the great teacher Anat Baniel, who teaches her works with children with all these physical disabilities, or even flute teachers I've worked with and Aikido teachers, is they don't get tired of it. They could just talk, and if you ever open that door, they will talk to you about it until the door is closed. And so maybe you can speak to this some. When I tell my students, my writing students, is pick the stories that you have to tell, that you never grow tired of telling. That perpetual curiosity seems to me so essential just to lead a meaningful life. Period.
Yes, and as a writer, you must know that a story is really the best way of talking about something. You could say something in an abstract way, but a story makes it real. It makes it understandable, relatable, particular.
Absolutely.
And without the encounters with people, I wouldn't have any story to tell.
One thing I was curious about, Finding the Blue Sky, when was this published? This was just published recently, wasn't it? When did it come out?
Yeah, it just came out October 4th. And in relation to stories, by the way, in this book, each chapter has three sections. The first section in every chapter is one of those crazy Zen stories, and I'm a fan of them. Sometimes we call them crazy wisdom. They're sort of like perplexing stories, and some of them are like puzzles, and the stories are entertaining because you don't expect what comes out. Then the second section is reflection, section of reflection, and the third section is always a practice, sometimes with a poem, sometimes with a guided meditation, with a meditation theme, sometimes with a song. And the songs and all this materials, the supplementary material is on my website also, so they're available to everybody as well. Yeah, stories. The heart of, you know, I'm learning to be a good storyteller. I think if you're a good storyteller, your book is going to be more valuable to people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't agree more. I teach storytelling, and I've come to understand that really story is the way we think. Story is the way we frame reality, because when we look at life, there are infinite ways to look at the same event, and the story becomes the way we choose how to look at an event. The story becomes how we frame an experience. I say to my memoir students, you can't change the past. The past is fixed in one way, but you can change the story about the past, and when you do, you usually change your present moment. So I think story is really how humans think and how we understand ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So true. So true.
You know. But what I was going to ask you is, this is an experience I have. I also teach a kind of spiritual approach to writing, and I teach it and talk about it and teach it and talk about it. But invariably, when I write about it, even when I think I'm going to write about something that I already know about or have talked to people about, I learn something new when I go to write. And so this is a book about mindfulness, which is something you've been practicing for decades, and yet I wouldn't be surprised to hear that in writing this book, you found maybe just a little something new that you hadn't predicted when you sat down to write it. Did that occur?
Oh, yes. Not just a little something, a lot of things for sure.
Yeah?
It helps you articulate what you're thinking. You know, there's so many wonderful things about writing. One of the things is that, say that you've sat and you started to, you know, ruminate or think, you could be sort of saying the same thing over and over to yourself. Like, how could he do this to me? Like, or why
right.
did he do that? I just don't understand
right.
it. But if you were
right.
to write it, there is very little chance that you'll write a whole page of how
yeah.
could he do
no,
this to me.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You write
yeah,
it once
yeah, it's true.
And then you move on.
Yes, right. One sentence will do it.
Yes, writing helps you move on to the next
yeah.
thing. Yeah.
You know, in fact, this is interesting. And one of the reasons I've been interviewing more people, having more people on the show who do mindfulness, either teachers or just interested in writing about it, is I came to understand that for me, my first spiritual practice was writing. And writing is thinking on purpose. Writing is being deliberate with your thinking, because on a very basic level, every sentence is a thought, and you have to choose every single sentence, which means choosing every single thought. And so for most writers, whether they are aware of it or not, they are practicing a form of mindfulness in just writing, whether it's romance novels or memoirs or what I do, you know. But it is,
for
you're
sure.
thinking on purpose. You're having to pay attention.
Yeah, and when you're rambling on purpose.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
And the thought is always with me. I want to say that, but does anybody else want to hear this?
Ah! Oh, I'm so glad to hear that a wise fellow like you is also cursed with the most basic of human questions that every writer faces. Joseph, does anybody else care what I care about? So you go through that too, huh?
Yes, it's it's a good way of choosing what you want to write, what you want to say. You know, sometimes I want to get it off my chest, so I write it, and I, you know, save it somewhere else as something else. Maybe someday it'll come in handy. But maybe it doesn't quite fit in this particular book, in this particular chapter.
Right.
There's
right.
always that choice, you know.
Yeah, it's true. With writing, just because something is a beautiful sentence or is a beautiful paragraph, meaning it's a beautiful idea, you know, I always think of ideas as the beauty, and the language just shapes them. Just because it's beautiful doesn't mean it belongs in what you're writing. It's not enough. It's got to fit, doesn't it? It's got to be a part of.
Yes. So that's a bit of editing that comes. It's not coming as you're writing. It's coming the next day for sure.
Yeah. Well, so, Joseph, now, what is your, when you think about the evolution of your work? Can you feel, do you sense where it's headed now, or is it really just a moment-to-moment thing, or do you feel some growth happening that you feel like you're pursuing right now, or is it just let me see what today brings? Is there some bigger picture you have?
Well, I find that I'm going, like I started more with the desire to teach mindfulness, but as time goes on, I'm sort of writing more of my own experience, and sort of the mindfulness part is coming out of the way I describe my experiences and so on.
Oh, interesting.
It's more autobiographical in a way. My latest book that hasn't been written yet or is being written right now, it's less didactic, if you like, less teaching, and
right.
more stories, more.
Oh.
Yeah. I enjoy that evolution myself. Mm-hmm.
Now, what was the most challenging thing? Because you come, so I have always been a storyteller. That's all what I've always done, always been. I'm an entertainer, and I learned to bring that over to what is generally called spiritual writing, which is what I do now. And so there was a lot I had to learn when I shifted from writing fiction to writing spiritual nonfiction, let's say. What was the biggest thing you had to learn when you began to become more interested in story as a means of communication? What did you find most challenging about that?
Well, in writing stories, one of the things is that it arises out of a particular occasion, the story of a person, the story changes a little bit as you tell it. You put more meaning into the story because the story is just for that person was an everyday story, but it begins to take on a metaphorical significance as you tell it. So in a way, you embellish a little bit story to make it tell what you want to tell, where you want to point at something. Do you do that too, or is that do you have that kind of approach sometimes?
Oh, it's critical. As I tell my students, and this is really true, no one reading your stories actually cares what happens. They care about the feeling you leave them. It's true. I mean, they might talk about what happened in the story, but what they care about is where you leave them emotionally, what transformation you reveal to them. Or another way of saying this is the story, even though if you wrote a story about something that happened to you, it's not about you, it's about the lesson that life gave you in that moment. It becomes about something bigger than you. And so absolutely you embellish, you take out, you put in, because the point is the gift. The point isn't what happened. The point is the gift, is the gift, is the gift. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
No one will remember the rest. They only want the gift. And that's what the story is there for.
But the gift is transmitted through the story, and
that's right.
That's the best way of getting it across. Very true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one thing to remember about story, which is so interesting, and I first really understood it in comedy. I love humor, where a comedian begins a joke and the audience laughs when they finish the joke. That's really the comedian leaves room for the audience to finish the joke. And the same is true of story. You finish the story. You start the story as the writer, but the reader must finish it. The reader must finish the story in their own imagination, and that's when the gift occurs. It's in that empty space that you leave within the story of really what you didn't say that they fill in their own imagination, and then the story is complete. And that's the beautiful part. It comes to life differently in each reader. It's really gorgeous. It's just gorgeous.
It sort of stimulates reflection, if you like.
Yeah.
And, you know, they talk about, and I mentioned songs becoming earworms.
Yeah.
I think a story can become a mind worm.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
And those little dead stories, they're meant to
absolutely.
Be a mind worm. Yeah. Go on.
Well, Joseph, it was a short but fascinating conversation, though I'm not through with you just yet. Not just yet. I actually have one more question that maybe you've answered already in certain ways, but let's just find out. What I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has it taught you?
To go deeper into myself, to look for something that is not a platitude, something that is not, something that comes from a deeper place. And that is also the process of meditation, to sort of calm the surface thoughts so that something deeper has a chance to surface, to come to the surface. And yeah, there is a lot of similarities between the process of meditation, creation, and writing, and I appreciate that a lot.
Awesome. Well, I totally agree. I meditate and I write, and I find I'm left often in a similar place. Well, Joseph, this has been a delight. Again, the book is Finding the Blue Sky, A Mindful Approach to Choosing Happiness, Here and Now. And obviously, it's available where all fine books are sold. But if people want to learn about you online, where can they do it?
MindfulnessMeditationCenter.org. And center is spelled C-E-N-T-R-E, the Canadian way.
That's right.
And explore the website, click away, and you will discover songs, guided meditations, and all kinds of other things.
That's wonderful. Well, Joseph, thank you so much. Good luck with this book, and good luck with all the stories you're writing now.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, this interview. I enjoyed it very much.
Okay. Thank you so much, Joseph. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. It's true. Joseph, what Joseph said was absolutely true. Boys and girls, go deeper. Life exists beneath the surface of the waves, beneath all the tumult. That's where life is actually happening. He's very right. Speaking of which, next week I will be doing another masterclass, a Fearless Writing Masterclass, on Wednesday instead of Tuesday, as always, with my good friend A.C. Fuller. So tune in, 2 o'clock next Wednesday, after Thanksgiving, if you're in the United States. And we'll be doing another masterclass. Bring your questions. Remember, what stands between you and the writing experience you want to have? If you have a question like that, send it to bill@authormagazine.org, bill@authormagazine.org, or go on Writer 2.0 and post on Facebook, Writer 2.0, that A.C. Fuller moderates. Go on there and post your question there, and we'll get it. Hopefully, I'll be able to answer it. Until then, you know what you got to do, people? Do what you love.